Absalom in terms of the drama of Absalom and his rebellion tonight. So let me say hi to everybody. It's great to see Naomi, and we know that Rosa's there with her, and Mom is here, and Ava and Leo right there. Siggy's here, and thanks to everybody for accommodating. Last night was a conflict for me, and I appreciate everybody's flexibility as well. So, you know, the story of David and Absalom is a story of a father and a son, and I thought that would be a fitting place for us to bring this series to a conclusion. Again, we'll deal with the aftermath next week in part 10, but basically the story comes to its conclusion right here. So we know that by virtue of divine providence, Absalom has taken the advice of Hushai Ha'arki over the advice of Achitophel, who committed suicide, and the battle will be waged tonight. David, right, the warrior, once again sets up the army, and he puts over them Sarei Alafim and Sarei Meot. The officers are in place. And he divides his overmatched force. This is always against military conventional wisdom. If you're outnumbered, you're not certainly not supposed to split your forces, but that's what David did. Robert E. Lee copied him many years later. Vayishalach David Adam, Ashlishit Biyad Yoav, Ashlishit Biyad Avishai Ben Tzriach Yoav, Ashlishit Biyad Itai Hagiti. We remember that Itai was one of the few who remained loyal and came into exile with David. Vayomer HaMelech El Ha'am. And now David, after he has, you know, set up his army, so he says to the nation, Yatzo Etzega Mani Machem, and he wants to go out to battle with them. Vayomer ha'am lo teitze. You shall not be the one to lead us into battle. We're going to come back to this point in a second. Ki im nos nanus liyasimu eleinu lev. Because if we run, right, nobody's going to pay attention to us. They're not after us. Remember that in principle, Absalom really shouldn't be interested in destroying any number of Jews because he's going to have to rule over these people. Please make note of that word, lev, of the role of heart. And even if half of us are killed or more, it doesn't really matter. What matters here is the question of monarchy. So that's the second time we've had lev. You're worth 10,000 of us. And this, of course, harkens back to the very beginning, when famously the daughters of Israel sang, right, Shaul bil alafav, Shaul and his thousands, v'David berivavotav and his tens of thousands, v'atatov ki tielanu me'ir la'azor, you'd be of much greater use, David, for us from the city. You can daven for us, you might be able to give us tactical advice, maybe you'll even be able, according to some, according to the Malbim, to send in your special guard, the Kresi Uplesi. But be that as it may, you're not coming out to battle with us. Let's take a moment here to think about the meaning of this. Now, again, this is a rebellion against David. David has been removed from the throne, if temporarily, by his own son. And David sets up the army, but when he says, of course, I'll go out to battle with you, his own army says, not a great idea. You'll be much greater help from the rear. You can pray for us, you can give us tactical advice, and you can also maybe send in your strategic reserves if necessary, but we don't want you coming out to battle with us. What does this signify? Why is this critical moment? Well, what is this? David's, these are the people who are the most loyal to David, right? They've crossed over the River Jordan with him. They've gone into exile with him. They're willing to fight and possibly sacrifice their lives for him. And yet they're telling David, don't come out to battle with us. And they have good reasons, right? Because that will make David a target, right? Let them fight for David. But how did we first meet David? And what does this signify? Remember, we first met David right? In the story of Goliath, effectively, right? When nobody else was willing to go to battle and he was the only one, he fought on behalf of the Jewish people. So now we have this closure, right? This full circle where the Jewish people, the ones that are loyal to David, are willing to fight on his behalf, but he's not going to go out to battle. But maybe we could even take it half a step further. You know, maybe this is a kind of a ma'avar, a kind of a transition, if you really think about it. Because, yeah, Absalom saw that David perhaps was aging, was becoming more passive, didn't do anything about what happened to Tamar, and eventually relented in terms of Absalom having killed Amnon. And so we noted that David was perhaps not the same. And maybe even those who are most loyal to him, who are willing to fight for his reinstallation as king, are also noticing the same thing. Right? They don't want David to go out into battle. Now, they have very specific reasons for it within this context, but in a broader sense, they're saying David should not be the one to lead us into battle. And I think that itself is a critical point in the Sefer. So Vayomer Alehem HaMelech, and so David says, Asher Yitav B'Nechem Esah, I'll listen to you. If you don't want me to lead you into battle, I won't. Vayamod HaMelech Al Yad Ashar V'Chol Am Yatzu L'Me'ot V'Lalafim, in their hundreds and in their thousands. And at this point in time, David says something which is obviously, you know, very controversial, but also very revealing. Vayitzav HaMelech Ad Yoav Ad Avishai Ad Itai L'mor La'atli l'na'ar la'avshalom. Be gentle. Go easy on Avshalom. He calls him a na'ar, as if he was, you know, but a young boy. V'chol ha'am shamu v'tzavot ha'melech et kol ha'sarim al devar Avshalom. And it was in front of everybody. It's a little ambiguous. Did he mean for them to hear? Did he not mean for them to hear? V'yitzeh'am ha'sadeh likrat Yisrael v'tiyah melchama b'yar Ephraim. It's interesting. Even though it's in the Transjordan where you only have Reuven, Gad, and the tribe of Menashe in the north, it was called the Yar Ephraim. And the Talmud tells us that even though, of course, it was the tribal area of Menashe, any tribe had the right to graze in the forest area of a different tribe. And I think this too is a significant point. It highlights the basic unity of the Jewish people, which Absalom and his rebellion are threatening. So the battle is waged in the Ya'ar of Ephraim, in the forest of Ephraim, which happens to be in the tribal area of Menashe. Vayinagfu shamam Yisrael lifnei avdei David, that Absalom's army, which is called Am Yisrael, are completely destroyed by the loyal and faithful warriors of David. Vatisham magifa gdola b'yom ahu esrim aleph, 20,000 of Absalom's soldiers were killed. Vatisham melchama nafotzer al pnei chol haaretz, the battlefront was everywhere, as he said in the War of Independence. Kol am tzava kol aretz chazit. And even more than the 20,000 that died by the sword, even more fell in the forest, either were consumed by wild animals, according to some, or they simply became lost and wounded and injured in the forest until there was nobody to find them. And in the thickets, they were running. And in this chaos and in this confusion, Vayikare Avshalom lifnei avdei David. So Absalom happened in front of David's warriors. V'Absalom rochev al hapered. And Absalom, who presents himself as the savior, right? He has this messianic image of, right, you know, riding on the mule. Absalom is riding in on the mule. V'yavo hapered tachat shovach ha'ila gdola. V'yechazak rosho va'ila. V'yutan ben hashamayim uvin haaretz. Remember Absalom, Gemara talks about this, Absalom nitga'a b'sa'aro, right? Absalom was so proud of his hair, and of course, hoisted by his own petard, his hair gets stuck in the tree, and the mule goes out from under them, and he's hanging between the heavens and the earth, and the Talmud wonders, why did Absalom not simply cut himself down? It says that he saw the image of Gehenim open underneath him and was scared to cut himself down. And somebody saw him swinging literally from the trees, from his hair. Vayar Ishachad, a nameless figure, Vayagid Yoav Vayomer, Hine ra'iti Rav Shalom taloi ba'ila. So, alright, so Avshalom, he's swinging from the tree. Vayomer Yoav la'isha magilo, v'ine ra'ito madu'a lo hikito shamarza. So why didn't you kill him, says Yoav says. The rebel himself. Ve'alayla te'vacha asara chesef aga chagora achat. I would have given you your just rewards. Vayomer ha'ish al Yoav, v'lu anochi shokel al kapai elef kesef. Right, you could give me 100 times what you offered. Lo ashlach yadiel ben hamelach. I would never strike the son of the king. He might be a rebel, but he's still the son of the king. Kivyo aznenu tziva hamelach utcha v'ravishai v'ritai le'mor shimru mi bana'ar be'avshalom. Because we all heard what David said to you, and to Avishai and to Itai, the three leaders of the different armies, that you have to protect Avshalom. O asiti v'nafshi sheker, and if I would have pretended that I didn't hear David say that to you, then I would only be lying to myself. O asiti v'nafshi sheker. I love this line. Right? You can fool other people, but the question is, can you really fool yourself? O asiti v'nafshi sheker. I would have been lying to myself if I would have pretended not to have known this, not to have heard this. V'chol davar lo yikached min ha-melech, and David would have probably figured it out anyway. Ve'ata titatzev mineged, and you would not have come to my defense, Yoav. See, there's no great trust in this man. Vayomer Yoav lo chenach ochila lefanecha, so Yoav says, okay, fine, not going to ask you to do it. Vayikach shloshash vatim, so he takes basically 3 darts, bechapo. Vayitka'em belev Avshalom odenu chai belev ha'ila. And Yoav sticks it through, these darts through the heart of Avshalom. 1, 2, 3. Avshalom is not dead yet. And it pierces through, comes out the other side of his body, out of his back, and he's literally pinned to the tree now. Right? And, you know, the Gemara comments, we spoke about it, right? That Avshalom was Vaignov Avshalom at Lev Yisrael, and then Lev Aviv David, and also the Leva of the Sanhedrin. So these 3 darts, each one is a Mida Keneged Mida, for a group that he deceived. And of course, the heart, noted tonight already on many occasions, the use of the term heart. Avshalom deceived and stole the heart, manipulated the hearts of the Jewish people. Vayasobu asara narim nosei chleg Yoav, vayakud Avshalom, vayamituhu. And so Yoav's 10... you know, let's say, arm bearers. He had 10 people that were in his immediate guard. So when they saw that Avshalom wasn't yet dead, right, so they go and kill Avshalom right there on the spot. The Gemara comments, why 10? Because there were 10 Pilagshim. David had 10 concubines that Avshalom had desecrated. Vayitka Yoav bashofar, and Yoav sounds the shofar. Vayashov ha'am eridof achrei Yisrael, ki chasach Yoav et ha'am. This is the second time. If you recall, all the way back at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, the second Shmuel, when there's a civil war, another civil war, the earlier civil war between David's faction and the faction that remained from the house of Shaul, right, blowing the shofar, halanetzach tochal chereb, blowing the shofar was the symbol that the war is over, and Yoav employs that same symbol to end this civil war. Vayichud Avshalom, and they took Avshalom's body, vayashlichu to vayar lapachad gadol. They put him in a forest, in a deep pit, in a ravine. Vayatibu alav gal avanim gadol meod, and they pile stones on top of him. This happened to Achan, Karmi ben Zabdi ben Zerach. V'chol Yisrael nasu ish leholo, and everybody else went home. The rebellion effectively is over. You know, earlier in his life, the Avshalom lakach vayatzev lo b'chayav et matzevet asher be'emek ha'melech ki'amar ein li ben bavur haskir shemi vayikra la matzevet al shemo vayikare lo yad Avshalom ad ayom hazeh. Now the irony the text is telling us is that Avshalom had already prepared a monument to himself. He said he didn't have any children. Now the truth of the matter is that the Navi recorded that he had 3 sons. So according to many views, they all passed away. According to different views, he didn't see any of them as really fit to inherit him. He didn't have a ben who was Hagun Lamalchus, proper Yorish. And so he had established this sort of monument to himself, and he called it Yad Avshalom, and so it was called until this day. But that's not where, and according to the simple reading of the text, that Avshalom is buried. Avshalom, rather, is buried in this ravine, in a forest, outside of the land of Israel, right? The battle is happening in the Transjordan. And he's buried there under a pile of stones after having deceived the hearts of the Jewish people and Mida Keneged Mida, receiving Shvatim. He deceived the Shvatim and he received Shvatim, which has a dual meaning, right? He received Shvatim, darts, in his own heart. And this is, as far as the confrontation is concerned, the end of the battle. Well, let's discuss some of the most important themes. I think we already did some justice to the idea that David is not going to be the one that leads them into battle. He will not be the one that leads them in war. But I think there are a number of other themes that we need to develop. David telling his three generals, Yoav, Avishai, and Ittai, not to harm Avshalom. And who's the one who doesn't respect this directive? No surprise, Yoav. Yoav is always the one. Always the one. It happened with Avner, and it's going to happen again with Amasa. Why does David do this? After all, Avshalom is a Moreh B'Malchus. What's motivating David? Is David in the right here? The people respect it. The soldier who sees Avshalom hanging from the tree won't do anything to him. Yoav has to do it himself. Was David in the right?
Are you asking why he spared Avshalom's life?
Oh. I could understand why he would do this as a father, but is it justified?
Well, I think he's a father.
What was his plan? What was he going to do with Avshalom? Let's say Avshalom had survived. Just send him back into exile again? Give him the same, slap on the wrist that he got for killing his brother?
It's a real problem because, he's done stuff that definitely deserves death. So, but I don't think wouldn't it be better to have some kind of formal trial or something, not just put it on David and Yoav to kill?
Well, right. I mean, because there's an option of having some kind of a, judicial proceeding. Typically, just a rebel against the king, Lamori B'malchus, would be somebody that would be, would be justified to kill him in battle. But Eva raises an interesting point. Is David... maybe let me put it in slightly different terms. What's the lesson here? David wants to always spare Avshalom, right? He always wants to spare Avshalom. The first time, after Avshalom killed Amnon, so he lets him go into exile, and then he brings him back to Yerushalayim, and then he won't see him, but after he's back from Yerushalayim, he comes back to the palace eventually. And he's always sparing Avshalom. Of course, it doesn't spare Avshalom in the end, right? Yoav will, happily... do the violent work that Yoav is known to do. So what exactly are we meant to take from this? And what's the message in terms of David's parenting of Avshalom?
He spoiled him.
He didn't really help him, did he? This desire... This deep, deep desire that David had to want to protect his son ended up deeply harming him. This is counterintuitive, but I really want to drill down. I don't want to, put too fine a point on it, but let me just, zero in on this point. there's a deep desire on David's part to want to protect and spare Absalom. But by doing that, he enables Absalom to do increasingly risky things from which David in the end can't protect him. And maybe shouldn't protect him. There are thousands of people, 20,000 people who died because of Absalom on this day. At least, those are just the military casualties, let alone the ones who died in the forest. So this wasn't... Yeah, Charlotte, go ahead.
Didn't David also try to spare Shaul?
He did. Though Shaul was, in fairness, Mashiach Hashem, the anointed one of God. And David, in his enormous respect for that office, felt that he could not take Shaul through violence. He would simply have to wait.
But maybe David also thought if all this is happening, that nothing could happen unless Hashem sort of let it happen.
Okay, so that's a very important point. A number of the Mefarshim raised that point, that David feels, and this is exactly what I was driving at, excellent, Charlotte, a very deep sense of guilt. Because why is this happening to him? He was told by Natan HaNavi, right, there will be, Hini mekim alecha ra mibeisecha, that part of the justice that comes David's way for the sin of Bathsheba, right, is the rebellion of Absalom. So there's terrible guilt here. If this is the punishment, then I have no right to hold Absalom accountable. Which isn't entirely logical, because the whole point is accountability. But David's, right, racked by guilt here. It's interesting, right? Yoav, who's the only one who really knows of David's guilt with respect to Bathsheba and the death of Uriah, etc., right? Yoav is a person with, you know, who just doesn't have that same conscience at all. He's a completely different figure. Naomi, go ahead.
I can't remember when, but earlier in his life, David was known to protect the people. That he felt responsible, and here he's just the opposite. That by not stopping Absalom, he caused a war and many people died, which is totally opposite of the younger David.
Ah, okay, so good. So now you're putting the two themes together, right, that when David said, you know, I'm going to go out and lead you into battle, like the days of yore, they say, you stay in the city. We'll manage this ourselves. That things have changed. And even David's most loyal and faithful servants recognize that. The Avdei David recognize that he should not be leading them out into battle. And Naomi is pairing that with the idea that David, if you look at it in aggregate, has not acted in a way vis-a-vis Absalom that actually promotes either Absalom's well-being or the well-being of the Jewish people. It's the worst of all worlds. It's one thing to protect your son at the expense of the people, and it's one thing to hold your son accountable if it means protecting the people. But David did neither. He did not really succeed in protecting his son. Maybe it was completely naive to believe that he could, number one. And number two is that, as you say, Naomi, his actions were not constructive. They were not productive as far as the Jewish people were concerned. In fact, they were highly counterproductive. Led to
I don't know, this might be what Naomi was just saying. Sorry, my video's not working. When the people said to David, no, you don't go out, you stay in the city, is it possible that they were aware that David would not really be able to go after Absalom and he wouldn't really be able to fight in the best way? And they for that reason, they wanted to keep him back, but only after did he actually give the verbal directive kind of to be light on Absalom. But before he said that, maybe the people anticipated that it wouldn't be a good idea to have him on the battlefield with Absalom.
It's an absolutely fascinating thought. I hadn't even considered it, but that they, in some sense, they even intuited this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe they would have been open and they could have gone with that until he actually gave the actual directive, like kind of like, don't touch him.
Right. Right. It's a really interesting way of looking at it. Excellent. Okay, so, you know, I think David's failure from a paternal point of view, is on very, very much on display in this moment. In the end, he can't protect Avshalom, and he allowed for, you know, a terrible calamity to befall the Jewish people. Now, admittedly, they were Avshalom's soldiers, but the Avshalom is a phenomenon that David created in many different ways. Last point that I wanted to speak about. It's really interesting. The text backloads information that theoretically should have been put earlier. Namely, that Avshalom had created this monument, this kind of a mausoleum to himself. Of course, he ends up buried very far from there in a ravine, in a pit, in a forest, underneath a pile of stones. But, you know, this Yad Avshalom, what does this tell us? I think it adds, insofar as, you know, this is the very end of the Avshalom narrative. We could have been told earlier in his life that Avshalom was looking, you know, to create some kind of an edifice, some kind of a structure. But by this being the final word on Avshalom, what does this do for us in terms of our understanding of his character and maybe in terms of our capacity to reframe Avshalom and his rebellion? What does this being the final image do for the story? The Yad Avshalom. And he said, Ein li ben, I don't have anybody that's really going to carry on my legacy. It's part of the reason I subtitled tonight's presentation of Fathers and Sons. Of course, it's about David and Avshalom, but it's also about Avshalom's sense, Ein li ben.
It's what you said earlier, like, I don't know, a bunch of sessions ago, but I guess it's what the rabbis talk about in his hair, but that he wants the glory. He wants it all for himself. He wants the name, the monument, that the physical edifice kind of represents really what he was going for from the beginning, perhaps.
Okay, Ruthie, that's excellent. And I think that this, there's a mission in Pirkei Avos in the name of Hillel that says the following, Negad Shemei Avad Shemei. That a person who seeks to aggrandize his name will lead to the destruction of his person. Eva, go ahead.
I think the reason they put at the end is to show the whole situation, the irony of it, that he was going to have this grand monument, and instead he's in a pit. And I think if they had talked about the monument earlier, it wouldn't have been a strong, great contrast.
Yeah, very well said, right? The backloading of this information, but Eva's pointing out, really highlights the contrast. It's only once we know the end of the story where Avshalom is buried that we can fully appreciate, you know, exactly what this means. It's very well said. How far he was from what his vision of success would look like. Another mission in Pirkei Avos that comes to mind, Hakina Vatava Vihakavod Motsinas Adamin Olam, that the pursuit of glory, right, can lead to a person's destruction. And so I think in and of itself it's an extremely important message to reflect on. That people who seek fame and glory and this kind of external approval, and I mean, Avshalom did it at this grand scale, but even doing it in more subtle ways, how dangerous that is. And I'd like to contrast Avshalom, who was seeking to perpetuate his own name, with another figure in this chapter, a much more anonymous figure, quite literally. Anybody want to guess who I'm referring to? Who?
The soldier who did not kill Avshalom?
Exactly, Mom. And remember what he said to Yoav? He says, I know what David said to you, and even if I was pretend that I didn't hear it, then what would I be doing? Asiti v'nafshi shaker. I'd only be lying to myself. I have to live with myself. And I think here you have basically two models in life. Is somebody living for recognition from other people? Or is somebody really being true to themselves and saying, in the end of the day, I might be able to lie and say, oh, I had no idea that David didn't want Avshalom killed. But asiti v'nafshi shaker, I'd be betraying myself, which is bad enough. which is bad enough. And I think that's exactly the idea. Here's this honorable person. We don't know his name because it wasn't important to him that his name be known. We, of course, know Avshalom's name, but not in a positive way. The world is filled with earnest, sincere, good people who history will never remember. But they never betrayed themselves. Him lo asuv nafsham sheker. And then history and the world is filled with people whose lives were defined by the false pursuit of glory and self-aggrandizement. And those are figures who are ignominious. And here, just to sort of bring things to their conclusion, you know, Avshalom said, Ein li ben, I don't have a son who's going to carry on my name. Interesting. Question for David is, will he? That's going to be a big part of our focus. But that wasn't the way, that wasn't the manner in which David thought. Here we see this fundamental contrast between Avshalom and David. Avshalom was so important to be remembered, to be acknowledged, to be recognized. These are going to be things and themes that we talk about next year when we talk about Shlomo and some of his limitations and doing things on a grand scale. But who was David at his core? David never asked to be made king. He was a shepherd who was overlooked in his own household, writing poetry to God, what became Sefer Tehillim. David was a young boy who jumped into a battle because he heard the name of God being desecrated, and that was too much for him. And he's catapulted into celebrity, but that's not what motivated him. His brothers accuse him of that, of his don levav, but that's not really what's motivating him. And so in terms of fathers and sons, the Lev Avshalom and the Lev David, they are really very different. David is somebody to whom celebrity came, fame came, because of his sincerity. And Avshalom was somebody for whom the idea of somehow not being the most important or the one who garners the most attention was so devastating that he was prepared to destroy himself in pursuit of that, in the end. Yad Avshalom. Remember, why is Avshalom doing this now? What did we say at the very beginning of the rebellion? He suspects that he will not be the heir to David. So you could say, well then, okay, so then he's got to do something. But what's so bad? What's so bad about that? He's going to have a terrible life. He launches this rebellion out of this deep fear that he won't be the king, that he won't, and therefore he won't be remembered and he won't be important. And I think the Avshalom narrative in the end is about how dangerous that is. There's nothing wrong with a person being famous for doing something quietly and legitimately to other people's benefit. But when people make being famous a virtue in and of itself, that's very often the path to catastrophe. And Eva, as you said, the dramatic gap between what Avshalom had envisioned for himself, the glory of this monument of Yad Avshalom, and the reality, the crushing reality of where he actually ends up, I think is very telling. And there is a biblical parallel as well, because we just read the story last week, Korach, Uvikashtem Gam Kuhuna, wanted to elevate himself. Of course, right, the Adas Korach ends up swallowed in the ground. Avshalom, who sought elevation, being exalted, ends up in a ravine, in a forest, forgotten forest, not even in the boundaries of the land of Israel. Avshalom, who so manipulated to come back, you know, from exile, from outside of the land of Israel, from Geshur, ends up in a ravine in the Transjordan outside of the land of Israel. And his co-conspirator in that, Yoav, the one who was responsible for bringing him back, ultimately is the one to kill him. So next week we're going to focus very heavily on Yoav and David. Yoav obviously, now, once again, has acted violently and aggressively. And it's going to be extremely important to understand the tension as it has existed, as it will continue to exist between Yoav and David. So we'll hold it up there, and God willing, we'll pick it up six nights from tonight, not a full week.
Thank you, Rob.